I'll call to order the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety. Colleagues, today is February 23rd. We're convened for a public hearing on Senate Bill 5542, the budget bill of the Oregon Youth Authority. Linda, is there anything you'd like to tee up for us?
I would call to your attention that in addition to the usual displays on OLIS of the LFO presentation, the agency's presentation, and the DAS presentation, there are two reports that were required by budget note during 2014. One is the 10-year strategic plan, and the other is the YRS and facilities report. So those are posted for your information, and the governor's budget is out there as well.
All right.
That's all I have.
Let's bring up the agency. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Shields and Williamson, and Representatives Barker, Gorsuch, Krieger, and Wisnant. My name, for the record, is Faribor Spaksrecht, OAA's director. I thought perhaps what we can do with me is Joe O'Leary, our deputy director. I thought maybe we can just provide a very brief background about who we are and then get into the presentation. I am a first generation immigrant, have lived in Oregon for nearly 38 years, and actually graduated from the school across the street. Have worked for the state of Oregon for 25 years in three different state agencies, Department of Administrative Services, Department of Human Services, and now Oregon Youth Authority. I came to OYA on a short-term assignment, and the reason that I'm still here is the realization that I could potentially have a positive impact on the life of youth, parents, victims, and hopefully make communities safer. This is the beginning of my seventh year in OYA, hard to believe, and the beginning of my fourth year as the agency director. Joe?
Co-chairs Shields and Williamson, and members of the subcommittee, for the record, Joe O'Leary. It's a privilege to be here as well. I know many of you and have met several of you recently. As many of you know, I served as general counsel and public safety advisor to Governor Ted Kulongoski. I am an alum of the House and Senate Judiciary Council Club, where I served in 2005. Previously to that, I worked in private practice in Portland, and prior to that was a public defender in the Multnomah County Courts, about 2.5 years of which was exclusively in juvenile court. And it's a absolute privilege to be here and to be part of this leadership team and to help steward the great work of this agency.
Thank you, Joe. We are, and I'm speaking on behalf of both Joe and myself, we are privileged to be leading this agency and are incredibly proud of our staff who day in and day out give their all to reform youth and to help them become productive and crime-free members of their communities when they return. We are excited to be able to share with you the agency's path, our accomplishments, our challenges and opportunities that we face in the coming biennium. Slide number 2 shows the outline of our two-day presentation. Today, we hope to share with you the agency overview. Joe will do that. And then I will share with you some facts about what's happening at the national level, how's OYA aligning or perhaps even leading that effort. What we are actually doing at the ground level to improve outcomes. And with that, I'll turn it over to Joe for the agency overview.
Thank you. We hope to cover this very first part of the presentation about 30 minutes to give you a little bit of the overview of what the agency looks like, what our program areas are, the youth who are committed to our care, what they look like, how they got to us, some of the challenges that they have in front of them. And then I'm going to give you a summary of some of the accomplishments and really exciting things that we have completed in the last 2.5 years since we appeared before an earlier iteration of this committee. If I could go back one, and you could even move this over a little bit. Thank you. And I will try to do this myself. Mr. Ayer kindly offered to be my clicker, but I...
He likes to be in control.
I was going to say service. I think slide 4 is the agency mission. Yeah, and I just said that I would control the clicker. There it is. I promise no jokes to Linda, so that'll be it. No more funny stuff. The mission of the agency is actually unchanged since the agency was created in 1995 by Senate Bill 1, which of course created the Oregon Youth Authority. Previous to that, Juvenile Corrections was really a division of the Department of Human Services. And you can see from the mission there are really two major themes, accountability and reformation. And I just want to pause for a second on this term accountability and let you know that you are going to hear over the next 2 days a lot of terms that are consistent with the developmental approach to juvenile justice. In fact, that term in and of itself is a relatively new one, developmental approach. You're going to hear terms like positive human development, collaborative problem solving, and trauma-informed care. I just want to let you know right in the front of this presentation that none of these concepts are mutually exclusive with accountability. We are here because of accountability. Youth who have committed crimes need to be held accountable. And to the contrary, some of these concepts that we are working on and on the cutting edge of are really bringing us into a shift that acknowledges a deeper meaning to that term accountability. And we're really proud to be part of the cutting edge of this effort nationwide. And we, with your help, I think we can make it sustainable. The next slide that I now control is an overview of the budget at a very, very high level. And in the next series of slides, I'm going to walk you through each of these primary program areas and let you know what each of these are made of. The first one that I'm going to focus on is a relatively small one. It's down in the bottom, payments to counties, $22.5 million over the biennium, 7%. This is a map of what that looks like. These are direct grant aids to each county juvenile department. We have a system of juvenile justice in Oregon where most cases are referred to and resolved at the juvenile court level. Local county officials resolve the lion's share of cases. And in a few slides, I'll show you actually the progression of cases of youth that actually make it to OYA from the counties is very, very small.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Director, can you tell me what Klamath, don't let Senator Wisnett know this, but why is Klamath and Umatilla so high compared to other eastern Oregon counties?
Co-Chair Shields and Representative Wisnett, what I can tell you is this is a formula grant that is based on population and juvenile crime rate. So those are the two factors that dictate the amount of funding. My uninformed guess is that Klamath and Umatilla, by population and crime rate, have warrant that grant, but that amount. But we can find out for you.
Thank you.
You bet. So again, purely formula grant, there is, and these, I should say, these dollars are critically important to county partners across the state. They provide backbone funding for county juvenile departments. They also provide special programs to divert youth from coming into state care. The next slide shows you what was displayed on the graph as 12% program support. This is a slide that shows you the many functions in the director's office, where we have the professional standards office. That is our internal investigation wing. We have four investigators. We have a PREA coordinator, the Prison Rape Elimination Act. We get over 100 complaints a month on average and have full-blown investigations ranging from about 4 to 5 every month. We also have in the director's office the Office of Intercultural Relations and Inclusion, which was formerly known as the Office of Minority Services under the leadership of Maria Travis Haraldson, who joined us about a year and a half ago and is really revising a lot of and reinvigorating a lot of what that office does. We have our strategic initiatives housed in the director's office, our research staff, which this committee gave us the flexibility to create last session, one rules and policy coordinator, government relations staff, two communication staff, and a chief audit executive. We also have all our business services functions in program support, like human resources, budget, accounting, procurement, contracts, physical plant, and our training academy. We also run our treatment services administration, actually, out of our program support portion of our budget. Those dollars help with clinical supervision over our qualified mental health staff, various certifications that different units and facilities maintain for alcohol and drug treatment, and lead our efforts for collaborative problem solving and trauma-informed care. We also, as you might imagine, oversee and contract out for a variety of psychological evaluations and services. And then finally, in this program support pie, a really big part of that pie is technical services. And our information services division not only services OIA, but it also services about 3,000 users statewide. I mentioned this county-state partnership in which OIA was forged, and that is still very, very strong in the form of the Juvenile Justice Information System, or JJIS. JJIS is a database that was created in Senate Bill 1 that now has 270-some-thousand discrete profiles of every youth that's ever been referred to a juvenile court since its creation in about 1996. The counties share JJIS with the state as literally a client management system. Later in our presentation and tomorrow, you're going to hear a lot about how we're harnessing the data in JJIS to bring, as we said in our budget note report, Moneyball to juvenile justice. Our next slide breaks out the close custody facilities. This represents, I'm looking back now at slide five for your reference, this is the facilities portion of our budget, which is 46% of our operational budget. We have 10 facilities around the state. The stars are where those facilities are located. Three of those facilities are camps. One of those camps, Camp Florence, is unfenced. We have one facility, Albany, the Oak Creek facility, that is dedicated to young women. And we have four facilities that we call regional facilities. Over the weekend, as I was preparing my remarks, I realized that I know we're going to use this term throughout this presentation, especially when our physical plant staff talk about our 10-year plan. So please forgive us in advance. I don't know why they're called regional facilities exactly, but when we talk about the regional facilities, what we really mean is all of the facilities that aren't McLaren or Hillcrest. Several of those were built in the early 90s following the voter-approved initiative Measure 11, but not all. And you'll hear a lot more about those. They're obviously in every region of the state. You'll also hear a lot about our physical environments. One of the things I just want to prime the pump on is that the physical structures of OIA for living units are very reliant on dorm settings. Our default living unit is a 25-bed dorm, and it's staffed at its most robust staffing time is the swing shift. That's three staff to 25 youth. You will definitely hear more about that. And I wanted to point out, late breaking in your packet, we supplied you with a letter from SEIU, who represents our staff in facilities. We'll also be posting that through committee staff to OLIS so that you will have that online. Our next slide.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Gorsuch.
To go back to the staffing level of 3 to 25, how does that match up with the national standard?
Co-Chair Shields and Representative Gorsuch, I don't know off the top of my head the national standard. I will find that out. Okay. The one that's off the top of my head that you didn't ask about, the things that are held out as best practice, mm-hmm. Best practice is 12 per unit, 12 kids per unit, mm-hmm. With about that same staffing ratio.
So more like 3 to 12.
Okay. Yeah.
Actually, that's fine. Best practices is good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I'm glad that I didn't have to go back in my PowerPoint slide because I don't know how to. These are the next couple of slides are going to show you the community services block of the pie, which back to slide five, they're listed as community programs. It's the blue wedge of the pie. This is 33% of our budget. And this is made up of a couple of different things. These are the locations of our parole and probation offices around the state. We have JPPOs and JPPAs around the state that carry caseloads of about 25 to 30 youth each. That is a combination of OYA youth and DOC youth. These folks are really our primary case managers. They shepherd our MDT process, multidisciplinary team process, which meets every 90 days on every youth to look at the progress the youth has made, individualize treatment, look at long-term and short-term goals, and continually do transition planning. They're responsible for transport, reintegration, court services. They collaborate extensively with juvenile departments and another entity that you're going to hear about tomorrow more, placement committees, which are the committees of juvenile justice professionals in local counties that actually meet on specific cases and make recommendations to juvenile court judges. We'll be excited to actually do a little role-playing with you tomorrow as a placement committee using some of the youth reformation system tools that we have put together over the last year and a half. The next slide, this is still part of our community services division, shows you our residential programs. You know, folks here, a lot of folks hear OYA and they think that we just run closed custody facilities. We actually have more kids in residential programs than we do in close custody. And these stars represent the 23 agencies around the state, the nonprofit agencies around the state with whom we contract to provide 45 unique programs. These are programs like St. Mary's in Beaverton, J. Barjay in Bend, Looking Glass in Eugene, Janus Youth Programs in Portland, and Catholic Community Services and several others. These folks make a statewide backbone. This was something that was really critical at the creation of OYA because there was an acknowledgement that some counties had a lot of local resources and some counties didn't. So the idea was to put aside a pot of dollars by which the state could manage residential services as an important continuum in juvenile justice. And from the provider's perspective, they like it too. They have a single point of contact at the state level. They don't have to do 36 different contracts with 36 different public agencies. From your perspective, each of these stars represent the opportunity to maximize federal matching dollars from Medicaid, which is obviously financially advantageous for the taxpayers of Oregon. The next slide, still on community services. These are our foster and Proctor homes. We've got 115 of these. 43 are foster homes, 72 are Proctor homes. The distinction is that a Proctor home is actually a foster home that's sponsored by a nonprofit agency, and we contract with the nonprofit agency. The foster homes are families that actually contract directly with OYA. These are remarkable people that do this work, and I don't want you to look at this map and think, great, you've got it covered. We need more of these folks. There's a great need, and there's particularly a great need for foster parents from communities of color.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just can you share with us when you come back just what your need is and where in the state?
Co-Chair Shields, Senator Winters, very happy to do that. Thank you. Next, I'm going to walk you through a couple of slides that are about the youth that we serve, the youth themselves. This is a map of the state of every county in the state that really show you the counties of origin. You have this in your material for reference. There is a number that represents the youth who are on parole and probation from the county, another number that represents the number of close custody youth from the county. Really the only story I think this one tells is that the it really follows the population centers across Oregon. The next slide, for context, gives you a sense.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Well, Madam Chair.
So used to that.
Senator
yeah.
Bates.
First, I apologize for being late. I'm a little nose problem here.
Oh, there it is.
I'm looking at Marion County versus Multnomah County, the county of origin. Multnomah County is 1 million people. I don't think Marion County is 1 million people. Is there some reason for that? State Penitentiary?
Co-Chair Shields and Senator Bates, great question. We get this question regularly. I wish I had an answer for you. I think your observation, underlying your observation, there are more people in Multnomah County than there are Marion, yet it appears the number of commitments from Marion are higher. The reason for that is something that would really need to be researched, and it's not something that we have delved into in a way that I can answer with a great amount of credibility. What I can say is OYA does not control who comes right. to us. The court, and this next slide will actually underscore this, the courts make those decisions at the recommendation of placement committees in each county. And, you know, there's a local control element to this, and some communities have different standards than others.
Senator Bates.
I don't want to take a lot of the committee's time here. But there's something going on here in Marion County that's either good or bad. It might be good.
If I might interject briefly, it is true, Senator Bates, that Multnomah County is the most populous county in Oregon. It's also true that they have the most resources. Multnomah County has been involved for a number of years with some national foundations to reduce the number of youth that are sent to the deep end of the system, so to say. You know, the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative and a few others. I suspect that those things have heavily influenced the numbers that are coming to OYA. So that's, again, my hypothesis, and we can find out more from they're great partners with us in Multnomah County, and we can find the answers.
Thank you.
I think we need you're looking at two case studies here. Why is one so much different than the other? And why should kids born or living in one county be treated different than kids born or working in another county when we're having state funds involved?
Yeah. In Clackamas County, it seems like they might be soft on crime. I don't know. Senator Winters?
But that also, you know, along that line, would also say, you know, where one county on the resource issue may have more resources, and why should another county that may not be denied those same opportunities? So I think there's two questions. There is the question of the maybe the soft or the harsh on crime, and also the issue of resource availability. You know, we hear a lot anymore among our colleagues in this building, whether we're talking about juveniles or the adult system or other resources, that part of our state is not enjoying the same economic boon that some of the other part of our state, particularly when we talk about the metropolitan area. So I think that is a really good question that's being raised, what and the whys, both on the soft, harsh, as well as the resource piece.
Please continue.
Thank you. I am going to move on to slide 14, which shows you an overview of how youth move through the juvenile justice system. I mentioned to you in the very beginning that most cases, most youth end up in the county juvenile department and never go really beyond an adjudication or county probation. But the other track out of juvenile court is through OYA commitment that can result either in out-of-home placement on probation or close custody to a youth correctional facility. Now, imagine kind of a dotted line down here, and below this line, this is the land of adult court. And the other way that youth end up in the care and custody of OYA is by virtue of an automatic statutory waiver into adult court based on what they are charged with, the seriousness of the offense. Those cases, if the youth are adjudicated, convicted, the adult court word, convicted and found guilty, they are sentenced to the legal custody of the Department of Corrections, but are placed in the physical custody of the Oregon Youth Authority. So long as they are under 18 at the time of the incident,
and under 20 at the time of sentencing. The youth authority then has the statutory responsibility to keep them in physical custody until age 25 or earlier if their sentence expires before age 25. If their sentence extends past age 25, we're required to turn those youth over to the Department of Corrections for the remainder of their sentence. I am now going to show you some scale photos of charts of the offenders who are placed in our care. This first circle shows you all the youth in Oregon, not in our care, but every young person ages 10 to 17. The second circle shows you the kids that end up getting the attention of local juvenile justice officials in counties. So out of that 390,000 cohort, only about 2,500 really end up in trouble, as it were, with local county juvenile departments. And then an even smaller number, 632. This is in a given year, so it's just the inputs. 632 end up in the custody of OIA. That is either in close custody or on probation, placed out of the home. So of the youth who are currently served by OIA today, I mentioned earlier that it's counterintuitive to some, but the biggest population of youth, 900 youth, are actually committed to the legal custody of OIA but are not in close custody. They are in residential settings. They are in one of those 115 foster homes. Many of them are older and living independently. Many of them may be back with family. And 629 of those young people in our care are actually in one of our 10 facilities. This is as of last month, January of 15. I'm next going to talk about the breakdown of the youth in our close custody. About half of them are the ones who actually come to us from the adult court, and half come to us from the juvenile court. Of the half that come to us from adult court, this is what they look like as far as the legal posture that got them to us. 179 are straight up Measure 11. About 104 are waived, which is to say we're charged with Measure 11 and either pled out of Measure 11, or a couple of them may have started in juvenile court, but because of the seriousness of the offense, they were actually waived into adult court. And then relatively very few, less than 10, who came to us through a narrow statute. I believe it's referred to as House Bill 1049, that is the Measure 11 escape clause, for some very narrow fact-specific cases. Here is a breakdown of the crimes of commitment that basically show you what underlying conduct resulted in the convictions for which youth have been placed in our custody. Next, we have a social characteristics slide that we update this every 2 years, actually. We do this by a hand count of all of our cases to determine some of these social characteristics, and it is pretty obvious that these youth in our care have been dealt a very tough hand. Majority have alcohol and drug issues, mental health issues, parental alcohol and drug issues, and conduct disorders. All of a third have special education requirements, and notably of the female breakdown, almost half have been victims of sexual abuse themselves. Back to my opening remarks about accountability and trauma, you know, this is not at all intended for us to kind of wring our hands and say, oh, poor them. This is absolutely about, if we don't understand what happened to these kids, we are not going to be successful in holding them accountable and making them successful in the future.
Just a follow-up, and I'm sure that, Mr. Chair, that others that was with us when we met with the offenders at Angola, because I represented Williamson, asked that same question, were you a victim? And so victimization, and of course there was a good response about, you know, if you've been victimized, then that plays out, in some instance, plays out to what the same as what you're talking about. And I think that's a category that we hadn't paid much attention to in the past. So I'm glad we are.
Co-Chair Shields, Senator Winters, thank you for the remarking about what I think about that as the intergenerational cycle, and that I think is it bears out in the research, and it's something that, again, makes it all the more important for us to collect this data and be mindful of it. Age breakdown, nothing all that remarkable here, so for purposes of time, I'm going to keep moving. The racial breakdown, did I miss gender? Let's see. Mm-mm. There's nothing too remarkable about gender either. However, it's to be sure, though only 13% of our population is female, the importance of gender-specific programming for girls can't be understated, and the acuity that these young women have when they come to us is pretty remarkable. Back on track with race and ethnicity, very troubling slide. This shows the racial and ethnic breakdown in Oregon and the racial and ethnic breakdown of the youth in OYA. This slide, again, is both youth in correctional facility and a youth correctional facility, and youth in the community who OYA supervise. I don't have a slide for this in this deck, but when you granularize it just to the youth in close custody, it is even more terrible. Hispanic youth in close custody, 26%, African American youth, 13%, Native American youth, 6%, Asian, 2%.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
Because we're doing some work looking at how that mirrors with the same statistics that we're seeing in DHS and some of their statistics as it has to do with foster care and their length of stay and some of the other pieces that some of us are beginning to pay attention to, and how from one part of our system and how that graduation into the other part of that system, and where should it be that we do some early on intervention. So, and I know that your director is a part of this discussion group that are talking about the sharing of some of this data so that we can begin to get a better understanding of where we are and how we can start doing some more effective work in prevention.
Co-Chair Shields, Senator Winters, we have a whole chunk of tomorrow's presentation that's going to be dedicated to our feeder system study that is looking at exactly that issue that you just highlighted. Thank you. I'm next going to wrap up my portion of the agency overview with a couple of slides that demonstrate the tons of things that we have accomplished. I'll keep getting ahead of myself. Thank you. The tons of things that we have accomplished in the last year and a half. We were counseled by one of your members to encourage us to toot our own horn a little bit, even though we're a diffident bunch and we like to kind of just kind of keep our noses to the grindstone and stay under the radar. There is a lot of stuff that we have completed that we're really, really proud about. I'm going to break this down by some of our program areas. The Title IV-E federal funds, you may remember from the last budget cycle, you approved some funding for a feasibility study around the viability of opening up this new pot of federal dollars, not a new pot, but new to OYA pot of federal dollars to subsidize some of the youth in foster care. We've completed that viability study. We've worked with DHS and the Judicial Department and are putting the final pieces in place. And expect to be opening up that faucet to an inflow of federal funds beginning in the next few months. We have repurposed, this next bullet is the family engagement piece. It's so important. We repurposed a position out of one of our field offices to actually serve as the lead family engagement coordinator for the agency. That staff has developed a family advisory council for the agency, and they're actually going through our policies and looking at it through the filter of family engagement with the intent of making our policies and practices even more family friendly, knowing that family engagement is a key indicator, according to the research, of future success. You're going to hear a lot about the YRS tools
And the testing, I told you we'll do a little role play, and you guys can play the role of a juvenile court judge while we walk you through a few cases tomorrow. And see how these tools that we've developed inform and make more robust the conversations about disposition of young people in the juvenile justice system. We've enhanced our residential capacity for females. This is something that is badly needed across the state. We started a new program with the Klamath County Juvenile Department to divert young women from being placed in close custody altogether. Similarly, in terms of a pilot program, we entered into a pilot with the Multnomah County Juvenile Department that we're really proud of to begin a new service in the continuum of juvenile justice, in-home services. So these aren't youth who have been placed in OYA custody, but they're at risk of being placed in OYA custody, and kind of everybody knows it. So the idea is, instead of removing them from the home and putting them in a YCF, a youth correctional facility, or a residential treatment facility, let's bring some of those treatment services to the home. Let's bring residential grade services actually to the home and try to prevent that youth from penetrating deeper and maybe helping the family out in the process. We just started that. Funding for that runs out at the end of the biennium, but we are hopeful that we can find a way to help move that along. The last bullet here, something that we're really proud of, is a initiative that we started also in the Multnomah County region. We call it our Measure 11 orientation. And what we do here is we actually bring our staff and some of our youth at OYA to the juvenile department court building in Multnomah County. And we go into the detention facility and we meet with youth who are pre-adjudication charged with Measure 11, probably going to end up in OYA custody. We give an orientation. This is if you come to OYA, we have a slideshow. This is what you're going to see. This is what it's going to be like. And some of our really remarkable young men come and talk to these kids. I've sat through a few of these. We've invited judges and prosecutors and district attorneys. We'd love to have any of you if you're interested. One of the other interests that we do this about every quarter, one of the other great things we do is after we do the session with the kids, then we break, and after 5 o'clock, we invite the parents of those young people who are being held in detention to come and meet with our staff and those youth as well. And in a few occasions, we've brought the parents of some of our kids as well. And we are finding that it is really helping prepare those young people and the families for what to expect. And frankly, it's increasing the safety of our kids and our staff at our intake. We have a centralized intake at Hillcrest. And you can imagine when, you know, kids are freshly coming into a youth correctional facility and in a dorm, as I mentioned, with 25 other kids and 3 staff, and they don't know each other and their new situation, it can be dicey. And knowing what to expect helps a lot. Facility services, some great things that we've accomplished. I'm actually going to start at the bottom of this slide. I'm really proud to say that we closed a program known as the Troy program, which was a long-term isolation behavioral modification unit on the McLaren campus. Facility is still there. We use it for very short-term isolation. In the 10-year plan, that facility, that structure is scheduled to be demolished. And the cool thing that we did after we closed that program was we redeployed the positions that staffed that program, and we made them into skills development coordinators. By made them into, I mean, of course, that we gave them enhanced training, focused training on proactive problem solving and skill building. And we sent those folks to the areas in our system where we had the most incidents, where we had the most challenging youth. And this is really making a big difference. we're really, really proud of the work we're doing here, and I think that's something that there's going to be more to come on that. Also, while I'm on the intake unit, we do have this centralized intake unit at Hillcrest, and just actually launching this week is a kickoff of a new re-engineered intake program. We actually had our staff staff that unit out on a two-week training. We have a huge work group, and some of the folks are sitting behind me. I'm not going to be able to do justice to all the work they did over many months to redesign the intake program to better align it to our culture, the culture we're trying to build, and to best practices. And I really think we're going to hear more good stuff about that. A couple of great things going on at McLaren. One of the ones I'm very proud of is this Two Spirits group, which is an LGBT group at McLaren. I understand, at least it was reported in the media, that McLaren was the first youth correctional facility in the country to have a coming out event in the facility. We were really honored to have Federal Court Judge Michael McShane come and speak at that event. It was also really great to see so many of the youth who are a lot of the youth who are straight who came there to support their friends and to be allies to the community. And I could talk about many, many more things, but I want to keep going and go to our educational services. The educational services are largely part of the facilities world in any event. While I'm mentioning FIRST, we have the first youth correctional facility in the country that now has a CLEP testing administrative function. The CLEP is the college level exam program. That's a test that you can take to test through credits after taking online courses. McLaren has the first one in the country. Oak Creek, our facility for girls, is going to come online in the next few months. We're doing some really remarkable things with that frankly didn't exist a year and a half ago in correctional settings when we last appeared before you, around massive online open source content. College credit classes in closed servers that our youth can take on their own time and then actually test out through these CLEP tests and earn college credit that they can take with them when they leave. A really huge event from the federal government around Pell Grants. The feds have now told us that our DOC youth will be eligible for Pell Grants, and that's going to open up a whole new population to take advantage of higher ed while in our care. And you've got the numbers that we're really proud of the high school degrees and college degrees over the last year. You'll recall that all of our kids in close custody settings have to go to school. If they don't come to us with a high school degree, they're going to be in high school. They're going to graduate. A lot of vocational services, I can't mention them all. Some of these are new ones in the last 2 years. Though firefighting is not a new one, it's one of my favorites. And the new development in our firefighting program that runs out of the Riverbend facility in Lakeland is that we just signed a contract with the Bureau of Land Management to do year-round prescriptive burns. So that is going to be on-the-job training for these young people. That's also going to be money. That's like a paid contract for them that's going to allow them to earn dollars to pay restitution and to develop some savings for their transition when they leave us. A great bicycle repair program operating out of Hillcrest that takes donated bikes. Our youth, under the supervision of a master mechanic, repair the bikes, and they are donated to foster children in the community. And I will stop there.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Winters.
Where's our quinoa project?
Co-Chair Shields and Senator Winters, I think you were referring to, ask you to refresh my memory.
Marion County Food Share.
We did last time we were before you, we were trying to work up a program that would have allowed OYA to repurpose a building on the Hillcrest campus to be used as a quinoa burger production line that then the food bank would use in their baskets and deliveries. I have staff in the room that can tell you more of the details of why that was ultimately not successful. But from the planning stages, we realized that it was going to cost so much to refurbish the building to get it into the place on the Hillcrest campus, to get it into the place that we needed to get it to become a commercial grade food processing structure, that it just wasn't going to be, the juice wasn't going to be worth the squeeze, as it were. We did kind of fall back to two plan Bs with the food bank, and they've been great partners with us. One of our plan Bs is that we've got kids that are not on fence restrictions, and we've got kids in the community that can go to the food bank and that can work in their commercial kitchen at the food bank. They actually have a certification program that's associated with that work. And the other plan B is that we actually enhanced a horticulture program, a growing gardening program at McLaren, and we're donating some of the food to Marion Pope Food Share for that.
Is that Representative Wisnant?
Are you finished with yours, Joe? I had a couple of questions.
I've got three more slides.
Yeah, wait. Does that, Mr. Chair?
You bet. Collaborative problem solving, trauma-informed care, and second look process. These are our accomplishments in the area of treatment services. I mentioned to you, and you'll hear more about what collaborative problem solving is, we've got now 148 OYA staff who are trained in the first competency level of collaborative problem solving, and 43 of them are trained in second tier, and more are coming. We've got an internationally renowned expert who's actually coming to train more of our staff for a two-day seminar in the coming weeks. Around the second look process, what I want to say about that is that several of you were on the Public Safety Commission and were present during some of these conversations about particularly the Multnomah County youth who plead out of Measure 11, but as a condition of the plea agreement, agree to waive a second look, even though they would be statutorily entitled to do so. Was actually out of some of those hearings that the then newly elected district attorney in Multnomah County reached out to OYA, and we started to talk with each other about our OYA's process in providing information to the court and the parties on second look matters. And we came up with three pretty solid revisions to our own process, to OYA's own process, the biggest of which is in treatment services, because it will require us to do a pre-second look psych evaluation. So we're going to do a fresh psych evaluation before the second look hearing and share that with the parties. And one of the things that's pretty remarkable about that is that the changes that we made prompted the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office to actually change its own policy around plea negotiations for these cases. And we are thrilled that we're able to provide better and more cogent information to the courts and the parties so that those kids get their day in court. Electronic health records, we implemented it. It's done. We've got it. It's pretty awesome. And here's the tooting your own horn. $325,000. $325,000 one time, startup, and $83,000 ongoing per year. That's what it's costing us. We did this. The platform we're using is called EPIC, and we're doing it by joining a consortium called the Oregon Community Health Information Network, or OCHIN. Beyond the cost-saving benefits, this is the system that's being used by a lot of the community health organizations, and it's going to provide for a seamless transition when youth leave our care. And we are also implementing electronic pharmacy records, and things are going really great there.
Senator Bates.
Yes, quick question. On your EPIC system, how many lives do you have on there?
Co-chair, Williamson, Senator Shields, Senator Bates. I am going to guess that it is the number of youth in close custody, 630, but that is a guess. Can I confirm that with our medical director, Dr. Adams, and let you know? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And is 83,000 a year or biennium?
A year. Yes.
83,000
for 600.
600.
I know, but the calculators are out. So,
calculators.
How much is that?
Time to switch slides.
I think a good doctor will have that number in a second.
Follow up. Is that only those in close custody, or are those that are also that were in close custody but have returned back to the community?
Co-chair Williamson and Senator Winters, the universe for the implementation is in our facilities.
Okay.
So there will be, there's a situation where I can say it's both. There's a youth in our facility today who has an electronic health records who's going to leave tomorrow. And that electronic health record will follow that youth.
So follow up. So what about those that are in facilities that are in the community, because they too sometimes have medical needs and what have you.
And
so how does those records flow?
Co-Chair Williamson's and Senator Winters, my understanding is if the community provider is using electronic health records, they will flow to us interoperably, if that's the right word.
If a miracle occurs, that will happen.
Yep.
Okay. It'll be a hard copy made and it'll be sent out. We're not to the point of having portals all over the state yet. You want the epic system. Not your fault. It's another issue. Right.
So, are you working closely with DOC as they talk about their electronic medical record system as well?
Co-Chair Williamson and Senator Winters, yes, we are.
That's where I wanted the linkage. Thank you.
You bet. So I'm going to wrap up and let you know that JGIS, which I mentioned before, has operating through our staff at OYA, but to the benefit of our 36 county partners and 3,000 users statewide. We continue to update JGIS and maintain JGIS, but I have to kind of give you the high sign warning. It's built on a really old platform, not going to last forever. And has got to be updated. That's not an ask before you this time around, but I don't think it can wait a whole lot longer.
Joe, when do you think that ask will come?
Co-Chair Williamson, if you really wanted it today, we could make it today. We did ask for a pop in the governor's budget. It was not approved. So we are doing the best we can to maintain it and to also use development expertise to begin to scope out what it will look like when we transfer to the new platform, which I'm told is a .NET platform, a Microsoft product.
Madam Coacher, before we go on to the next category, can you tell us what vocational training program that you have for your female population?
Co-Chair Williamson and Senator Winters, I have a list of vocational training in my packet, but I don't have it broken down. May I get that to you tomorrow?
You can get it back to us.
Thank you. We have completely revamped, going back to slide 28, we've completely revamped our training process. We have also, you're going to hear a lot about the 10-year plan, so I will not spend any time on that. And then my last slide is some of the things that we have accomplished through our strategic initiatives, which frankly you're going to hear all about in the next presentation and tomorrow's presentation. This is all around the youth reformation system. Positive human development, and really changing our culture and using data and analytics in a different way to inform professional discretion. So I will.
Question from
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Director, on slide 19, we're talking about the social characteristics. The gang association seems awful low if we're spending so much money and attention from the public safety community on gangs, if 16 and 7 correct, I'll just make that a comment. And then on slide 21, on, back on the social characteristics, 89% of the females, you know, mental health disorders is scary, I guess I'd say. On slide 21, you might get back to us. Are there trends on the numbers of female and male? I thought I understand the female population is increasing as far as public safety. So any comment on that later would be appreciated. Thank you.
We'll get that for you. If there are no other questions, I'll turn the floor, if it pleases the co-chair, I'll turn the floor over to Faribault to walk you through the next part of the presentation.
Thank you, Joe.
Oh, Senator Bates. Okay.
I don't know if it's appropriate time to ask the question, but maybe we'll do it off record. About 2 years ago, there was a meltdown at OIA in Grants Pass. It kept pretty quiet. I never got a full story of what happened there. And I'd like to hear about what the breakdown was. I've heard three different stories on what happened, why it happened. But I like to hear it offline, and I think the rest of the members of the commission here or the committee here should actually have an understanding of what happened there. I think it was a bigger event that people want to admit. I think it's been kept very quiet, and it goes to the heart of what you're trying to do.
Thank you, Senator Bates. We have our Assistant Director for Facilities sitting behind me, and we'd be glad to provide you all that we know. With that, Chair Shields, members of the committee, the next part of this presentation is about achieving optimal outcomes, and what I'd like to share with you is what's happening at the national level and how OIA is responding to it. We refer to this shifting focus in youth corrections, and you might have also heard the term swing of pendulum in juvenile justice. And so if I might, just for a minute or so, I'd like to share with you just a very brief history of juvenile justice to put this swinging pendulum effect in perspective. Going back, because when you look at the juvenile justice world, we have seen a shift from a punitive approach to a therapeutic approach, back to a punitive approach, and now in the recent years, we are seeing now a more developmental approach. So if I may go back for a moment to the colonial times, basically at that point, anybody under the age of 5 was considered a child, and anybody over the age of 5 could potentially be tried in criminal court, adult court. In fact, this is fascinating. I just found this out. In 1648 in Massachusetts, a child who cursed his natural parents could be put to death. That's the beginning of, you know, dealing with children.
All the good old days.
May have been yours, but it wasn't mine.
Second-time offenders.
So in 1899, the first juvenile court for youth under the age of 16 was established in Chicago, and other states quickly followed. In 1974, Congress passed the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, which to this day actually governs the operations of juvenile organizations in the country. The act requires separation of juveniles and adults, and mandates that we do not institutionalize status offenders. Due to a series of shootings in late 1980s and early 1990s, the public began to fear a new breed of what they might have framed at the time as juvenile super predators, and that resulted in significant changes to national policy. Every state passed laws making it easier to try juveniles in adult criminal court. Within the past 10 years, we've seen a couple of different rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court. One is forbidding the death penalty for juveniles, and the other is significantly limiting life sentences without the possibility of parole. In the last 10 years, we've also seen a variety of different approaches emerge around the treating and dealing with youth offenders. In 2013, a book emerged by the National Academy of Sciences. The book is titled Reforming Juvenile Justice, A Developmental Approach. And this book has become basically the benchmark of practice in juvenile justice. So I just want to share with you what this new approach is about and how OIA is responding to it.
Mr. Chair.
Yep. Representative Gorsuch.
I just want to go back to the super predator thing. Isn't it true that that was a discredited theory, that it never was borne out by the statistics?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, as the director of this agency, I have no comments.
Okay, thank you very much.
We're not to take a position here, but I think based on the increased rate of crimes back then, there was this sentiment by the public that we're not doing enough to respond to the criminal activities of youth. And I think the response to that today is perceived as overreaching. So, you know, we're turning the dial back.
There we go. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. You're welcome. So, basically what this approach, again, highlighted in this national document that just came out 2 years ago, what it tells us is that if we want to improve outcomes for youth, we have to focus on pro-social development of youth. And in fact, if our focus is on pro-social development, we would be able to improve outcomes for youth, to create safer communities, and to reduce future victimization. The key considerations of this new approach is the foundation of it is accountability, preventing reoffending, fairness and equity, and reducing disproportionate minority contact, which Joe referred to, which we also have a problem with in OYA. There is an increased emphasis on scientific research, use of data, and use of predictive analytics to inform decision-making. This is a big thing nationally. And at the core of this practice and this philosophy is that juveniles are different than adults. And in fact, you know, due to two different factors, brain development, which we all know, brain science, the adolescent brain developing up to age 25, perhaps a few years later, and the fact that those of us who are in charge of these systems have a huge responsibility not to truncate and not to harm that developmental cycle. And in fact, anything that we can do to support that developmental cycle would pay huge dividends down the road in terms of fewer crimes and fewer victims. And finally, supporting the psychological needs and development of youth. And what they say on that front is that there is absolutely a necessity to have a parent or a parent figure, not necessarily a parent, but someone who's there day in and day out, caring about the outcomes for youth, and basically managing their affairs and making sure that that youth is on the right path. A peer group and a living environment that actually models those kinds of behaviors that we want to see in the youth. And finally, the development of autonomous decision-making and critical thinking. And these are elements that are lacking visibly in the youth who come to us. That's the national approach. So what have we done in OYA to basically deal with this approach? And keep in mind that although this is coming from the National Academy of Sciences, there is lots of disagreements about the approach. There are still many who believe more punishment would pay dividends. And so, you know, we as an organization do not want to get caught in the swing of the pendulum. So the approach that we have taken in Oregon is by asking a series of very pointed questions. Number one, are we bringing the right youth into the juvenile justice system, and are we placing them in the right environments to address the risks and the needs that they have? What should the capacity of our system be today and in the future? What is the optimum length of stay? I mean, we already know what the aggregate length of stay ideal is. Many organizations have come out with numbers, but what should it be for each individual youth? Can we get to that? What are the most effective interventions to maximize public safety and youth success? How do we effectively reintegrate back youth into their communities? Because that is a major point of failure. We might spend 3, 4, 5 years with the youth, but if they're going back and do not have the right support around them, they will fail. We see that very often. How do we know, and I think you're very interested in this, all of you, how do we know that the money that you're giving us to operate with and provide treatment with is being spent effectively and is actually paying dividends and having the right return on investment? What type of organizational culture do we need to have in order to support a new approach to dealing with youth? And finally, Are we willing to provide our staff with the training, the tools, and the knowledge that they need and support them in going down this path? With that in mind, what we have done and the way that we have responded to this in Oregon, not just only Oregon Youth Authority, we are working with 36 counties on this front, is we have created a framework to create better outcomes. This framework is comprised of a system that we call the Youth Reformation System, the same system that the budget note in the last session instructed us to go and implement. It has a culture associated with it, which we call the positive human development. It has a series of practices and tools that helps us operationalize the system. And finally, it has a measurement component in place that determines if you're getting the return on investment. So what is the Youth Reformation System? The Youth Reformation System, and again, you will hear about this in more depth and detail tomorrow, but it is a system that uses data, research, and predictive analytics to improve outcomes for youth, inform decision-making, support professional discretion, and this is pretty important. We're not talking about turning youth into numbers. We have people in this organization who work with youth day in and day out. They know a whole lot more about youth than a data point might inform us, but that data can be helping that individual make the right decisions for that youth. Can we reduce future victimization by use of the system? We believe that we can, and it will also allow us to maximize the resources that we have. The system has four different components: population forecast, placement and treatment, program evaluation, and community context. Again, this has all been built and developed in Oregon. In a nutshell, the system is bringing the right youth in, putting them in the right place, providing them the right services, keeping them for the right amount of time, and transitioning them in a way that they can be supported and be successful. So, very briefly, the four different components, the placement and treatment. What this is about is now that the youth and that's the population forecast. This basically addresses two different components: short-term forecast, which is the demand now for the system, and a longer-term forecast. On the short-term forecast, we are actually working with Office of Economic Analysis, Department of Administrative Services. Our forecasting chair is in the room, Director of Linn County Juvenile Department, Tori Linn. We have developed a methodology that uses statistical equations to minimize recidivism and make sure that we have the right capacity in the system. The longer-term forecast refers to what Senator Winters was talking about earlier, the feeder system, who she is a legislative sponsor for, that shows what point of contact the youth have had before they actually arrive into our system. And can we begin to have early interventions to divert youth from our system? That requires a data warehouse that we're in the process of developing, and we are working with a number of other agencies. We'll talk in more depth about that tomorrow. The placement and treatment talks about, now that the youth is at our doorstep, can we actually assess this youth with the tools that we have? Can we begin to identify the risks and needs? Can we provide the right treatments and services? And can we make sure that we have the right interactions with youth while they are in our care and custody so that they can be successful? Again, at the end of the day, maximizing the potential for positive outcomes and leading to safer communities. The program evaluation answers the question, can we know the programs that we're providing are effective or not? I know some of you know a whole lot about evidence-based practices and Senate Bill 267 that instructed us to implement evidence-based practices. This really takes Senate Bill 267 to the next level, because while evidence-based practices help us understand what kind of programs are evidence-based, we don't know for sure if those programs are actually producing the outcomes and results that we want. And the program evaluation continuum is focused on developing that. Again, Dr. Paul Baladi tomorrow will talk in depth about the program evaluation continuum and what it can do for OYA and, for the resources that we're spending. And finally, the community context is in two pieces. Community context, one in form of the feeder system. What elements, what programs, what contacts are creating a pathways for youth into OYA? Can we begin to find the feeder systems that are actually contributing to that flow into OYA? And can we work with our system agencies going back to early childhood in order to provide resources for those communities and for those youth to divert them from OYA? And on the back end, can we begin to work effectively with communities to make sure that we're providing the right resources and support so that when youth transition back to the community, they can be successful? Again, Dr. Shannon Myrick and Dr. Paul Baladi tomorrow will talk in depth about these various components of the youth reformation system, but in a nutshell, this system addresses all of those questions that we asked in slides 34 and 35. The practices and tools, actually, let's next go to the culture before practices and tools. We need a culture to put this new system in place, and that culture in OYA is referred to as positive human development. Now, when you say positive, you might imagine that that might be not holding youth accountable, or maybe that's about creating a bunch of happy youth. That's really not what it's about. Breaking this thing down, positive means healthy, optimal, growth-focused, and strength-based. And this practice actually emerges from the national phenomenon of positive youth development. Why did we call it positive human development in OYA? Because we believe that all individuals who interact with youth, everyone who works for us, all of our volunteers, ourselves, can be developed, even though, you know, our process of brain development might have stopped a long time ago. And my case maybe is diminishing, you know, by every year. But still, as an individual, I can develop and I can learn. Every time I have an interaction with a parent, I learn something new. Every time I have an interaction with a youth, I become enlightened about what works and what might not work. Staff can do the same thing. So positive human development really expands that concept of positive youth development to all of us. And then, of course, development is the changes that we want to see in behaviors and abilities over time. This system is built on the foundation of safety and security. We cannot do anything without the staff and youth feeling safe and secure. After all, we run youth correctional facilities. And for this system to be successful, we have to provide an environment of caring and supportive relationships. This is not just for the youth, it's also for staff. At the heart of this pyramid is the high expectations and accountability. And in order for us to be successful, we have to have meaningful participation by both youth and staff. And finally, because we don't operate in a silo, and these youth go back to communities, community connection becomes a pretty key component of succeeding in implementing this positive human development. And finally, we have to have a series of practices and tools in order to be able to operationalize the system. The beauty of what we're trying to do in OYA is connecting research with implementation. There are great studies that sit on shelves and collect dust and are never implemented. There are huge problems with implementing great ideas. In OYA, our researchers are on the ground working with our frontline staff and revising the philosophy and the practice that we have in order to align it with reality. So what we're basically doing is we're providing a series of tools and training to our staff. Joe briefly talked about those, collaborative problem solving, trauma-informed care, advanced behavioral directives, evidence-based treatment, curricula, education, vocation, and life skill programming, and last but not least, culturally and gender-specific programming, which is part of the tools that we provide. There are a series of specific tools that have been developed in Oregon. Again, Dr. Myrick will talk about typologies tomorrow, which is unique, been developed in Oregon and is being noticed nationally. And finally, how do we begin to measure our effectiveness? Because you can't really see this slide, you have actually distributed the hard copy of this document that you see on the screen. This is called a fundamentals map. OIA is the first state agency that developed this map in conjunction with Mass Ingenuity, a small consulting firm in Portland. We have been doing this now for the past 4 years. This map demonstrates every function that we have within OIA. Every staff in this organization can find themselves on this map. It has our mission, vision, and values. It has our key goals. It has our core processes and supporting processes. It has every single sub-process that we are engaged in OIA. And there is measurements attached to those sub-processes. And ultimately, at the bottom of this map, you see outcome measures and key performance measures. The author of this model, this fundamentals map, is John Bernard, who has written two books, Business at the Speed of Now, and then just last month, Government That Works. OIA is mentioned extensively in both of these books. Again, as being the pioneer of putting this system in place in a governmental agency. Every quarter, our assistant directors stand in front of the management of this organization and report on the process measures and outcome measures that we have. This map is attached to a scorecard that you see on the screen. And let me just go through one example. If you actually look on the very top of that screen, it says Outcome Measure 1A. When you look at the bottom of your map in front of you, Outcome Measure 1 is Youth Feel Safe. So this is basically the measurement of that outcome measure that is reported on, and not on a quarterly basis, but every other quarter. And when you look at this line, again, on the top of the screen, you see that we have developed a baseline. It's basically broken into two things, youth in facilities and youth in residential setting. We have a baseline of, you know, we want to be over 80%. Under 80%, we're basically in the red. Between 80 and 90%, we're in yellow. And anything over 90% is green. And you can see that for facilities, we are running in the red, just barely, you know, another a tenth of a point, we'll be running in yellow. And for field, we are running in green. Now, again, our assistant director for facilities, who's sitting behind me, Clint McClellan, owns this measure. And what is it that they're doing to address this thing? They're actually, through the training and the in-service for staff, which youth also participate in positive human development, we hope to be able to move this measure within facilities so that youth begin to feel safer as far as, you know, their environment, as far as dealing with each one another, and as far as dealing with staff.
Director, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So do you feel, and do you have evidence to conclude that Measure 11 kids and adult waived kids, DOC kids, basically in OIA, are getting the same services as non-DOC kids at OIA?
Chair Shields, yes. There is no difference between, in fact, when you walk into our facility, you cannot tell who is a DOC commit kid and who is an OIA kid. They get the same services. They get the same benefits. The only difference really is the length of stay. The youth who are committed to us through adult court to stay with us a whole lot longer. And for that very same reason, most of the DOC youth end up in college programs because, you know, if you're under the age of 18, you're still in high school. Some of those youth, many of those youth have much more in-depth interest in vocational programming, which some of the younger youth who are committed to us through juvenile court might not have, because if you're going to school, then you might not have the opportunity to spend your time in vocational programming. Those would be the only differences. There is treatment provided that is crime specific. There is treatment that's provided that's, you know, if you have addiction, whether you're a DOC youth or OIA youth, you get the same thing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gorsuch.
Can you tell me the author again of Government That Works?
It is John Bernard.
John Bernard.
Yes.
Thank you.
And he's actually local, lives in Portland, and his book was just released. One other thing that I, so really I'm sharing this with you to show that, you know, we just had our 16th quarterly target review, and we're using these measures to improve outcomes. And I just have one other example for you before we wrap up. And I think we still have a few minutes, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So let me go back. Okay, so if you look at, again, that big map that you have in printed format, key performance measure one, actually key performance measure two is youth runaways. This is something that we measure, and this measure is actually focused on our residential programs. As Joe shared with you, we have 900 youth in our residential programs, and because we get Medicaid funding, there are no fences, there are no locked doors, these youth can walk away at any time. And if they're away for 4 hours, even if they come back, they are recorded as runaways. We measure this, and when you look at this chart here, you can see that we've been measuring since 2012. And this thing is going, you know, it was going in the undesirable direction. You can see that basically our target right now, we want to be at 80 or lower. And just last quarter, we were at 119. So what happened, again, you know, there's this old saying, what gets measured gets improved. We began focusing on this, and, you know, credit to our Assistant Director for Community Services, Phil Cox, and Chris Scrayback, that actually manages these programs. They brought a group of people together. They did a survey of 288 youth to try to find the core reason for why youth run. Because, you know, if you're just looking at the numbers, then you're just dealing with the symptoms. But why is it that the youth run? They surveyed all the providers. They did a literature review. They formed a work group. And this is what they found out. Youth run because of lack of family contact and support. They run because they're not feeling connected or supported. They run because they do not have positive relationship with program staff. And last but not least, this is pretty important, they have a substance use or abuse problem. These are all contributing factors. Furthermore, the youth who run are most likely going to run in the first 90 days of placement. So what that tells us is that more intense supervision is required during that time. Females run at a higher rate than males. Parole youth, those youth that actually emerge from our correctional facilities, run at a higher rate than those that come from the probation world. And approximately one-third of the youth who run once actually run again. So those numbers are not necessarily the number of youth, they're the number of runs. And finally, and again, you will hear about this tomorrow, typology is a phenomenon that we invented. It's a tool that we have invented in Oregon. And there's 6 typologies for males and 4 typologies for females. But typology A, which is a high-risk, high-need typology, runs at a higher rate than other typologies. I just wanted to share that with you to demonstrate one example of digging deep as a result of gathering data and trying to get to the core reasons of why things happen. Because if we get to the core reasons, then we can begin to do something about that. Now, as a result of doing this stuff, you can see that the last quarter, our numbers have dropped from 119 to 49. Now, I want to be completely transparent with you. We don't expect this number to hold, but we also don't expect it to go up to 119. We anticipate, based on the numbers that we have and projecting for the next quarter, we're going to be right around 70 to 75. We hope to bring it down to about 61. That's where the green is. And you might ask, well, then why is your target higher than your green? Our target right now is at 80. The reason for that is because it is unrealistic to get to 60 overnight. We have to have incremental targets. And basically, if you put an unrealistic target in front of a group of employees to meet that, you'll, you know, disenfranchise them. They will get disheartened and are not going to be able to give their best to reach there. And these are the targets that we developed jointly together. So, you know, again, our hope is to turn this trend around. Again, just one example of the kind of work that we're doing in OYA. What you're going to hear from us tomorrow in the presentation, you're going to hear about the budget note that the 2013 legislature gave us and instructed us to bring back a plan for the implementation of the Youth Reformation System and a 10-year facilities plan that looks at optimizing our physical infrastructure. We'll be focusing again on the Youth Reformation System implementation, the positive human development implementation, and the details of the 10-year plan. With that, that's the end of my presentation for today, and we'd be glad to take any questions that you might have.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your Youth Reformation System plan, and I know that, you know, you talked about community connections, how deep are you going to go into that presentation? You know, particularly, and a number of us are interested in, quote, the transition from your facility back into the community, and whether or not you're going to add those barriers of what happens once the individual returns to the community. I just find it interesting because there's an expectation of not only us as legislators, but of the community, for you to do these jobs inside of your facility as though all is well when you return them back to the community, and not what responsibility or what should be expected of the communities itself. That's both not only in the juvenile system, but those of you who know me, mm-hmm. of the adult system as well. It's pretty, and then when the recidivism numbers go up, we ask the question of why you didn't do your job. So I'm wanting to know that community connection to me is very important, because without that preparatory work, you know, you've done a lot on the inside, and the rest of the pieces may or may not be there. So I hope you're going to spend some time in sharing with us that community connection piece.
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, we don't have a whole lot of content on that for a couple of reasons. One is that work is still in development. And as you know, there is this Governor Reentry Council. There are about seven different work groups. There is a business reentry that is chaired by Dick Whitnell. I know you know that. There is a juvenile reentry that one of our staff chairs, and we are developing strategies for reintegrating youth offenders back into the community. One of the challenges that we face, Senator Winters, I know you know about this stuff a whole lot more than even I do. Our biggest challenge is reintegrating DOC youth back into the community. On the OYA front, those kids who are committed to us through the juvenile court, we have all kinds of resources for reentry. For adult commits, community corrections does not have the budget or the kind of focus that they need to have on these youth. You know, the caseloads are very heavy. I know one county, Klamath County, has probably the least number of caseloads, 1 to 40, which is manageable. But when you have 100 people on your caseload, there's just not that opportunity to spend as much time and effort on that front. What we're talking to Dick Whitnell about is institutionalizing what he's doing on an individual basis and creating a system that can provide a catch basin for these kids. So tomorrow we'll talk about that, but we don't have a whole lot of content. Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, Director, you talked about the importance of parent and parental figure, mm-hmm. talked about reason for running away is lack of family. If Dr. Myrick or Tamar or during the next testimony could talk about any effort to do the Family Find DHS program, I would like to hear about that. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Just
Representative Barker.
Thank you. Director, I haven't been up to McLaren on a regular tour for a few years, but when I was up there before and we talked about the safety, they were saying, oh, we can't have this kid with this other kid because they're different gangs. Have you been able to kind of curtail that? I mean, it seems like that enhances the I'm important because I'm in a gang.
Chair Shields, Senator Barker, Representative Barker, we are working on it. We have not figured that out yet. That's and you know, the question that was asked earlier about gangs, those are self-identified. So I anticipate, and I think Representative Wisnant, we have the same perspective and hypothesis, their numbers are a whole lot higher. But we are working on it. We have a gang task force right now that is actually working to address those issues, Representative Barker, and we can talk about that briefly.
Okay,
and,
I just wondered if you helped. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for sticking in there. We are meeting Monday through Thursday this week, and we'll pick up OYA tomorrow. This meeting's adjourned. This meeting's adjourned. Pick up OYA tomorrow.